Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
When we talk about the unemployment rate, we're using an average. That includes both the low rate of 4% in Fargo, North Dakota, and the almost unimaginable 27% in El Centro, California. And unemployment is often at its worst in towns that relied on a single industry.
They're closing down textile mills across the railroad tracks. Foreman says these jobs are going, boys, and they ain't coming back.
5% unemployment in Omaha, Nebraska, almost 20% in Yuma, Arizona. All of the individual stories from unique places that make up a national average. What's it like where you live?
Be your own town. Be your own town.
Moving from the general to the specific, the view from Main Street on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, March 5th, and I'm here with Todd Zwillick. He's filling in for John Hockenberry, who is sick today.
Good morning, Celeste. Let's get right to some of the stories we're following at 1 minute past 7 this morning. We're learning more about last night's shootout outside the Pentagon. Pentagon Police Chief Richard Keevil says two police officers were wounded when a gunman, 36-year-old John Patrick Bedell, approached a security checkpoint.
As the officers started to ask him for his pass to get into the Pentagon, he drew a weapon from his pocket and started shooting immediately officers. He didn't say anything. He just engaged the officers.
The officers returned fire, killing the gunman. Doctors say those officers were only grazed and will be okay. There have been concerns overnight Bedell may have had a partner, but last hour, Police Chief Keevil said,
at this time, and I emphasize at this time, there doesn't appear to be anyone else acting in concert with Mr. Bedell.
We're also learning the shooter reportedly posted messages on the internet showing resentment against the military and doubting the facts behind the September 11th attacks.
February unemployment numbers come next hour. Economists expect a small rise to 9.8%. But unemployment across the country is patchy. It's higher in some areas than others. And we're going to be looking at how unemployment has affected the small economic engines of America. We're joined now by Jay McLaughlin. He's chair of the Community Council of Glenwood, Washington. And it's pretty early there in Glenwood. Jay, good morning.
Good morning.
What is the unemployment rate in Glenwood?
You know, the best figures we have are countywide, and they've dropped down to just under 12%.
12% is still pretty high. What are the ideas there in your city for getting jobs back?
At this point, it's perseverance. There's not a whole lot we can do in our community that's so dependent on the timber economy.
Okay, grit your teeth and get through it. Jay McLaughlin, we'll be back with you in just a moment.
President Obama wants to see progress on health reform before he leaves for an Asian trip in the next 2 weeks. He huddled with more than a dozen House Democrats at the White House yesterday, telling them the chance for an overhaul for health care is the political opportunity of a lifetime. After the meeting, Congressman Joseph Crowley of New York told reporters,
I think when all said and done, we will have the votes to pass health care reform.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he hopes to unveil the reconciliation bill that will help pass health care next week. Meanwhile, the House passed a jobs bill, mostly along party lines yesterday. It gives companies that hire jobless workers a temporary payroll tax break.
Moving now to Chile. Early this morning, a strong 6.3 magnitude aftershock struck the city of Concepcion, sending people running into the streets. There have been more than 150 aftershocks since last weekend's earthquake. Taking a look at the market. Its futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,444, the S&P at 1,122, and the NASDAQ at 2,292. Coming up, we're going to be talking to Bobby McFerrin, not just the voice behind the song Don't Worry, Be Happy, but a part of a family legacy.
For you, Celeste, and we're also talking this morning about a controversy where a team of white dancers won a competition of stepping that's a style predominantly danced by blacks. You can find out more on the website at thetakeaway.org, but we're asking you, what does this say about race? And we want to open this up to you. What examples have you seen of one race owning something, and what does it mean to own something culturally? 8778-MY-TAKER, post to the website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're host of a small-town economic roundtable, as Celeste said, the millions of tiny economic engines that are driving this U.S. economy in a few moments.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. John Hockenberry is out sick today. I am joined by Todd Zwillick, who came up from Washington to fill in. Good morning, Todd.
Morning.
We are expecting new national unemployment data out in an hour or so to give us an idea of where the economy is moving on the large scale. But like I said before, that national data is an average. What about the individual data points that are the small manufacturing towns, the small economic engines of the United States, especially manufacturing jobs? They've taken a really hard hit. And we were trying to find out what happens to some of these small towns when the big plants shut down. Joining us for our small town economic roundtable, we have from Glenwood, Washington, again, Jay McLaughlin joins us, the chair of Glenwood's Community Council. Also, Mayor Paul Grenier from Berlin, New Hampshire, and finally, Mayor Jack Scoville of Georgetown, South Carolina. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jay, let's return to you for a moment. How large a town is Glenwood, Washington?
Very small, only about 500 people.
And what historically was your economic engine?
Timber.
And when did timber start to go south?
Actually, two decades ago, in the early 1990s.
So it hasn't been very long.
Hasn't been real long, no.
And what's replacing it?
At this point, we're still hanging on with timber. A little bit more tourism than maybe in the past, but still very much a forest-dependent economy.
Okay, Mayor Scoville, let's talk about Georgetown, South Carolina. How many people live in Georgetown, and what's the economic engine there been historically?
The city itself has about 9,500. The surrounding counties around, I think, about 90,000. We are a 300-year-old community, rice, indigo, way back when. We're a seaport. We've historically been sort of the commercial hub of this part of South Carolina.
In your manufacturing town?
Well, to a large degree, we have a steel mill that's now closed right in the middle of town, and we have a paper mill that's on the edge of town, and two other large manufacturing concerns that are in the county that provide a lot of jobs for our citizens. We're going to be promoting tourism a lot more, and hopefully the steel mill will reopen in the next year or two.
Okay, and what's your unemployment there in Georgetown, South Carolina?
The county is about 14.5%.
Okay, and finally to you, Paul, what is it like in Berlin, New Hampshire?
Well, we've got a city that in the 30s was about 22,000 people, and now we believe through the censuses we're going to be right around 10,500 people. We were a community that was born from the pulp and paper industry, and the people who built the pulp and paper mills at the turn of the 20th century originally came here and operated sawmills. In the early 20th century, we had an IP mill and Brown Company. We actually had two pulp and paper mills here in the city, and now that has evaporated. We have a small paper mill in the surrounding community of Gorham that used to draw pulp from Berlin here. So our pulp and paper mills have just about all gone away. At one point in time, the industry employed about 4,000 people, and now we've got about 350 people left in the industry.
Okay, so Paul of Berlin, New Hampshire, what is the unemployment rate there around?
Berlin's unemployment rate is about 10%. We've had a pretty significant out-migration of folks, but in the northernmost county of New Hampshire called Coos County, our unemployment rate mirrors the fella in South Carolina. We're about 14-15%.
So all three of you are from cities in which your real unemployment rate is actually higher than the national average. Jay, let me ask you about that national average. Do you kind of see economic numbers coming out nationally that make you feel like those have applications in your town? Or do you kind of feel like your town is an individual place and it's going to come out of the recession when it is ready?
I'd say the latter, much more of an individual place, and even within our county, because the numbers that we look at are countywide. Within our county, I have the impression that we have quite a bit of variability in the eastern portion of the county. it's much more open. It isn't forested. There's been quite a bit of activity and development associated with wind farms going in. But in the western portion of the county, which is forested and much more tied to the timber industry, times have been much harder.
Okay, Jack Scoville in Georgetown, South Carolina. How about you? Do you see some of the maybe the federal initiatives? Do you think that there's hope for you coming out of some of the stimulus money or the things that are large macro projects?
Well, we are getting ready to start about a $15 million drainage project here in the city, and we've got a couple of million dollars of stimulus money for that. Hopefully that'll create some construction jobs for local people. The steel mill is dependent on the international steel market. They have not closed permanently, and hopefully they'll reopen in the next year or two if international steel prices, you know, get high enough to warrant that. We're promoting tourism very hard here. We are a historic seaport town and unique. We've got actually more pre-Revolutionary War houses here than Charleston, South Carolina. So a lot of people discover us and are surprised. They think we're sort of a grimy mill town, but when they take the time to come to our downtown, they're very surprised at how, you know, beautiful a little historic town we have. So we really promote right now tourism, but of course that's affected by the national economy too.
Well, Paul Grenier, let me ask you, as mayor of Berlin, New Hampshire, you know, it's not just Detroit that is adversely affected when you're focused on one particular industry. What advice can you give to other mayors of other towns that were really kind of reliant on one particular industry?
All I can say is work to diversify your economy. Back in the early 2000s, late 1990s and 2000s, we recognized that we were slipping away. We have since located a New Hampshire State prison here in Berlin, which employs 300 people. And we are at the end of a federal corrections prison here that will be opening up next year, and it's going to employ about 400 people. And we're getting into renewable energy, biomass, power facilities, and we have windmills that are going to be going up about 50 miles north of us. So we have been very, very active in the last 15 years to counteract what I would consider a long, slow decline in timber-related businesses.
Okay, a little snapshot of small towns across the United States that kind of put these national unemployment rates into perspective. That's Paul Grenier, mayor of Berlin, New Hampshire. We also spoke with Jack Scoville, mayor of Georgetown, South Carolina, and Jay McLaughlin, who's chair of the Community Council of Glenwood, Washington. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
At 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
The police chief at the Pentagon says the gunman who shot two police officers last night at the entrance to the Pentagon metro station appears to have acted alone. John Patrick Bedell of California was armed with two 9mm semi-automatic weapons and several magazines of ammunition. Police Chief Richard Keevil.
He was very calm. There was no distress in his appearance. He walked very directly to the officers and engaged.
The 36-year-old shooter died last night from head wounds when police officers returned fire.
President Obama is continuing his push to get the health care bill passed. He called more than a dozen House Democrats to the White House yesterday to garner their support. And White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says if the reform is put off again, Americans will face further premium hikes from insurance companies.
Right now, the typical family insurance premium is about $13,000. That'll go to $24,000 by 2020 if we don't act, if we don't do anything.
The president wants the House to pass the health care bill within the next 2 weeks. Finally, a congressional committee approved a resolution to name the World War I era killing of Armenians by Turkish forces a genocide. In response, Turkey, a key Muslim ally for the U.S., has angrily withdrawn its ambassador in Washington. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, again, unemployment numbers expected out later this morning. Do they really matter, though, in the scope of the recession when you get to small-town America? What do those national averages mean? Got to talk about that in a few minutes.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some takeouts on stories we're following this week. I'm Todd Zwillick, by the way, in for John Hockenberry, who's out, and I'm here with Celeste. Well, right now, economists are waiting for the release of last month's U.S. unemployment numbers. Good or bad, those numbers may just miss a bigger picture going on here, one that shows that our current recession may be different, deeper in a way, than any recession we've ever had in the past. Indeed, a lot of people are calling this the Great Recession. Joining us now is friend of The Takeaway, Lakshman Ashutan. Lakshman is managing director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute. He joins us from here in New York. Lakshman, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you're describing an economic recovery that in the short term may not reflect how deep this recession is for people in the long term. Kind of two different pictures here.
Yeah, really a split screen. Look, we all know that this was a doozy of a recession, and on a lot of measures, it is the greatest recession since the Depression. And with all the talk of recovery, I mean, there's some numbers that are going up, like GDP, but everybody's saying, you know, show me the jobs. Where are the jobs? And it's a perfectly valid question. And when you look at all of the stories of people who have been unemployed and unable to find a job, you know, it really hits home. It becomes very real. When you look at the data, it really jumps off the charts. There's something underneath this headline kind of 10% or 9-something percent unemployment rate that we'll hear about today.
And Lakshman Ashutan, what is it exactly? If we have what economists like you call the jobless recovery, and we never recover back to 3.7%, instead we recover back to 5%, let's say.
Right.
What does that mean underneath the numbers?
Well, what's happening under the numbers is really striking. 40% of the people who are unemployed are long-term unemployed. They haven't had a job for 6 months or more. And the recovery is totally leaving them behind. They are not, even though other people are getting jobs, the other 60% of the unemployed are actually getting jobs quicker than in the past two recoveries. So you have one side of Main Street is having a quicker recovery in the job market, and the other side of Main Street is not having any recovery at all. And in a way, that kind of explains these really polarized stories that we're hearing in the news.
It's sort of a first out, last back in the job market, not a first out, first in. You lose your job first and you stay out longer.
Well, you know, it's weird. We're looking at, so who are these long-term unemployed? Who are these people? And what we see is a story of the aftermath of the bubbles. You had a bubble in construction and credit. And a lot of businesses and jobs that were feeding into those areas of the economy before the recession, those jobs aren't coming back. They're never coming back. Because those were bubbles. It's, you know, the bubble just doesn't reinflate again. And then the other thing is, every single time in those last few recessions, any manufacturing or factory worker who loses a job really doesn't have it come back when the recovery happens. And those are the people who are in the long-term unemployed. It's a major, major problem for the country as a whole.
And what about what's going on in Washington, quickly, Lakshman Ashutan? Congress is passing jobs bills, trying to give tax credits. Any big effect on the long-term as you see it?
No, it's not going to affect the long-term unemployment. Look, you're only going to hire someone if you have to hire someone, not because you get a couple thousand dollars tax break. If you're on the margin and you're saying, do I hire him this month or next month, this kind of plan could help a little bit. But the long-term unemployed, you're not going to reinflate a bubble off of a tiny jobs package.
Okay, Lakshman Ashutan, Managing Director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute. Stay with us because we want your take on the week ahead. But you've joined us. Thank you to talk about job numbers and a potential jobless recovery. Stay with us, Lakshman.
And finding out whether or not it's a good week or bad week for unemployment. Well, because it's Friday, in cooperation with our friends at The Week magazine, we take a look and see who had a good week, who didn't, in our segment Good Week, Bad Week. First up, good week if you like to rant and you live in Nepal.
It's a time where you can just let loose and tell your friends and relatives what you really think of them. And some popular insults are things like monkey face, I hope your sons are as ugly as frogs, and I hope your buffalo die of diarrhea. and some even more obscene ones than this.
That was the BBC's Joanna Jolly in Kathmandu, Nepal. She's talking about a ritual going on right now where young people from neighboring villages in Nepal get to hurl insults at each other in an annual festival that they say is all good fun.
But apparently it's all very good-humoured, and parents don't really mind what their children say, and children can say what they like to older people, and it's a chance for everyone to just enjoy themselves and say what they really feel without it leading to an argument or a fight or something worse than that.
So, Anakshman, we were actually wondering if you had a favourite insult.
If I have a favourite insult, oh gosh, I might call someone an economist. How's that?
Celeste saves all her insults for me for internet messages. I want to point that out. They're there, but they're just on the internet. Well, Celeste, not everybody had a good week, of course. Paul Railton, a young London dog owner, is out about $100, and he even lost his driver's license while he was having a dog day afternoon.
This man, who's 23, was spotted taking his dog literally for a drive. I think that's the best way I could describe it. The dog was on the outside of the car. The lead was leading through the window inside the car. And Mr. Railton was driving down what I would describe as a country lane at some speed and allegedly taking the dog for a walk.
That was arresting Officer Trevor Watson from the Durham County Constabulary in England. And Officer Watson says that Railton got just what he deserved.
We hope he's learned his lesson. We hope he exercises the dog in a more conventional way and he gets to the streets and walks them outside of his vehicle, bearing in mind he now can't drive his vehicle. So that's got to be good for Mr. Railton, and I'm sure the dog's going to be much better off by having a proper walk. So we're pleased with the outcome.
Lakshman, maybe you can analyze this in terms of productivity numbers coming out of...
Just about. It sounds like he was watching one of those Chevy Chase vacation movies or something.
Yeah, it does sound kind of unbelievable. We always ask who you think had a good week or bad week in the news. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our site, thetakeaway.org, and you can see the full Good Week, Bad Week feature in the Week magazine that's on newsstands and online now. Coming up, Iraqis go to the polls on Sunday for the first full parliamentary election since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. We're going to talk with Tom Ricks, contributing editor to Foreign Policy Magazine.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry this morning. Iraqis go to the polls on Sunday for the nation's first full parliamentary election since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Violence is on the upswing in Iraq, and we talk about whether these elections might be derailed by that violence and more. That's coming up in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. We're getting more information about last night's shooting at the Pentagon. Two police officers were wounded when a gunman, 36-year-old John Patrick Bedell, approached a security checkpoint, pulled a gun from his pocket, and opened fire. The shooter was killed when officers returned fire. Pentagon Police Chief Richard Kievel says the cops should be okay.
One of the officers was hit in the thigh. The other was hit at the top of his shoulder. Both were superficial.
And in the last few minutes, CNN obtained some internet rantings of the shooter.
To prevent themselves from being enslaved, the powerful masters of our existing governments use every means at their disposal, including bribery, theft, and murder.
Bedell also spends time doubting the facts behind the September 11th attacks. Police say they've had previous contact with Bedell.
A new report says the number of right-wing militia groups that see the U.S. government as their enemy more than doubled in the last year. That's according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting President Obama is close to receiving a recommendation from advisors that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed be prosecuted in a military tribunal. The White House initially wanted to try the self-proclaimed mastermind of the 9/11 attacks in Manhattan. If the president accepts that recommendation, Congress could approve the funding needed to close the Guantanamo Bay prison and replace it with a facility in the U.S. And a BLT could be harder to come by in the coming weeks, not because of the lettuce or the bacon, but because of the tea. Florida's January cold snap has taken a toll. Tomato growers have lost about 70% of their crops. Florida is the only U.S. state that produces large amounts of tomatoes in the winter. Sad story. February unemployment numbers come out an hour from now. Economists expect a small rise to 9.8%, and that's affecting the markets. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,444, the S&P at 1,122, and the Nasdaq opens at 2,292. Those are some of the stories that we're following.
Election Day in Iraq is this Sunday. This past week has seen a combination of electioneering and violence. Now, there's a lot at stake in these elections, in no small part because it'll determine who is in power when U.S. troops make a planned withdrawal from Iraq. That's supposed to be this summer. Tom Ricks is with us this morning. He writes the Best Defense blog on foreignpolicy.com, and he's author of The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq. Tom, good morning.
Good morning.
Tom, I want to go right to the latest uptick in violence. There's some recent bombings in Baghdad and elsewhere, and widely seen as an attempt at scare tactics in the run-up to the election. Do they have any real chance of influencing or even derailing the process?
I don't think so. I think some violence is to be expected. I actually think it's been rather less than we might have seen. It's part of their script. Of the people who don't like the elections. I am actually much more worried about the 3 months after the elections.
Why so?
Because that's the period of government formation. Under the parliamentary system, you have 325 people elected out of about 6,000 candidates. Those 325 people then have to find themselves a president out of their group. Then the president sits down and says, okay, which of the coalitions are going to combine to propose a prime minister? That can take several months. Remember those purple finger elections back in 2005?
Sure, sure.
Those were a direct factor in leading to the Civil War of 2006 because it took so long to form a government that ethnic tensions really increased. And then when the new government came into power, it had a hard sectarian face on it. And that really antagonized Sunnis and lit the fuse for the Civil War that inflamed central Iraq in late 06 and early 07.
You have any feeling, Tom Ricks, that there have been any lessons learned from that first round of elections that when it comes time to for government formation, that they might be able to sidestep some of the landmines that they encountered in the past?
I'm sure they learned some of those things. My worry is that back in 06, 07, it was the American intervention that really put a lid on that civil war and separated the parties and said, everybody calm down here.
And
the Americans are not prepared to play that role this time. The Americans are much more focused on trying to get their troop numbers down. We have about 100,000 troops there now, close to the average of what the Bush people had for many years, and they want to get it down to 50,000 by the end of August. That's a formidable task. And so I think you're not going to have the Americans around to bail them out, and all the things that caused violence last time, all the major questions about the future of Iraq are still out there.
Well, let's hear about that from General David Petraeus. He was on Charlie Rose on Thursday speaking to this issue.
The important change in August is that we will change our mission officially. We will go into the advise and assist mode rather than the combat mode, if you will.
Now, Tom Ricks, General Petraeus is saying that we will change our mission officially in August. He's saying that before we see what happens in the three-month aftermath of this election. That's a risk.
It is. It worries me because while I think President Obama has generally done a very good job in dealing with these really hard issues, I worry that by sticking to deadlines, he's repeating a fundamental Bush administration mistake of rushing to failure, of insisting we're going to go by a date certain and we're going to toss the ball to the Iraqis no matter what.
And it's also possible that forces in Iraq, likely maybe, that forces in Iraq who read that date certain read it as a cue for when to instigate violence, I suppose. Well, violence is just...
no question that people are keeping their powder dry for the post-American future there.
And violence is just one part of the story. Perhaps an even bigger concern is something that Iraqi-born blogger Raed Jarar addressed. Jarar lives in the U.S. now, but he's going to be voting in these elections. We want to play some tape for him, Tom Rickson, and get you to react to it.
I am concerned about what will happen after the elections. I'm afraid that we might end up having a situation similar to what happened in Iran after the election, post-election unrest, because there are many calls of fraud already.
Okay, so he's speaking much to the issue that you've been speaking about, Tom Ricks, but it makes me wonder if there is a security apparatus in Iraq in place to instigate the kind of post-election or political violence similar to what we saw with Tehran and in Iran?
Yeah, there are two aspects of that. The first is we really don't know how good Iraqi security forces are at this point. This is going to be a major test, especially when they don't have Americans around. How good are they? Who are they loyal to? Are they loyal to Maliki? Are they loyal to the government of Iraq? Are they loyal to sectarian groups or political parties? I've heard people give me answers of all those. The second thing is, how equitably do they behave? How decently do they behave when the Americans aren't around? Do they go back to the old Saddam ways? A lot of American advisors will tell you that that's what they expect from Iraqi forces once we're not there to keep an eye on them.
Well, Tom Ricks, is there any wiggle room in U.S. posture here? We heard from General David Petraeus, we are changing our mission in August. You're not the only one who's worried about it. Is there any flexibility in the U.S. approach here if things go wrong?
I think there's a lot of flexibility. I think President Obama has shown a lot of flexibility. Remember, he threw out his campaign promise, which was to take out a brigade a month from Iraq from the day he took office. If he had done that, we would have almost no combat troops left in Iraq.
Do we have political flexibility to stay there in a forward-leaning posture or even expand if we need to?
I think he does. I've knocked around the country a lot on paperback book tour in the last month, and what struck me is people understand Iraq is a mess. They don't blame Obama for him. They blame George Bush. They're sorry they ever heard of the place, but they're going to give him a lot of leeway in dealing with it.
And what about Iraqis, do you think? Their elections are coming up. Do they see this as the end to U.S. involvement in their country?
I don't think so. I think actually Iraq may reopen the question and ask us to keep some troops there for a long time.
All right, they may. Tom Ricks, contributing editor to Foreign Policy Magazine. He writes the best defense blog for foreignpolicy.com. Tom, thanks for joining us. Coming up, you may only know Bobby McFerrin as an amazing voice behind that old song, Don't Worry, Be Happy, but we're going to change how you think about him. The story about the power of family to shape you later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. After weeks of anticipation, the Academy Awards is finally upon us, right? Everyone's been holding their breath, waiting to know. 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, Oscars will be handed out. Acceptance speeches will be cut off by either a hook or a playoff of music. Here to tell us about this year's show, which will be on ABC, is Rafer Guzman, Takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday. Well, they've been promoting a lot the two hosts this year, Steve Martin. And we also have Alec Baldwin. Now, Steve Martin, we've seen before. What are we expecting from these two hosts?
I think, I hate to say this because Steve Martin is a hero of mine. I mean, his early comedy albums changed my life. But I think we're going to be looking to Alec Baldwin to bring the fun for these things. I feel like Steve Martin's, he's been in a sort of a morose period lately. You know, he's been writing books like Shop Girl and things like that. And I don't know if you saw It's Complicated, but Alec Baldwin steals that movie, and he's hilarious in it.
He's a funny guy.
He really is. And he has the new reputation of being this comedic genius. Yeah. So I think he'll be the one to watch.
Okay, so I'm wondering, what do you think about the structure of the Oscars? You know, they always try to do something every year to get the ratings up. What surprises are we expecting this year?
I don't really know. I think they've been a little tight-lipped on some of this stuff. I think what's going to be interesting is Mark Shaiman is the musical director. Now, if you don't know who he is, he's a Broadway veteran. Hairspray is probably his biggest, most best-known thing right now. Do you remember Billy Crystal's great Oscar medleys?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So Mark Shaiman wrote those. And he's back. And here's what's interesting. So he could do a good squeeze down of all the Oscar-winning songs.
They got to make it quick.
Songs.
They have 10... nominees.
But he's refusing, he says, I think he's serious, he's refusing to play off anyone in the middle of an acceptance speech.
Wow, really?
So who will make that cut, I don't know. But Mark Shaiman apparently says he will not be doing that.
And the question is, who is going to actually take advantage of that since he's made that a public announcement?
That's right.
Who's most likely to get up there and not stop talking?
Sandra Bullock, that's my guess. That's my guess.
All right, so we're going to get the quick rundown from you on who you think is going to win. All right, Best Picture.
Got to be Avatar.
Okay. Best Actress?
Best Actress, I think, is going to be Sandra Bullock.
Really?
I think she's going to get that one for The Blind Side.
Okay, so Best Actor?
Best Actor will definitely be Jeff Bridges from Crazy Heart.
Okay, that's kind of a giveaway. Best Supporting Actress?
Supporting Actress, I think, will definitely be Monique from Precious.
Precious,
and deservedly so, I'd say.
And that's I agree with you there. Best Supporting Actor?
Best Supporting Actor is going to be Christoph Waltz from Inglourious
really?
Bastards. Yeah, I think he's just got it in the bag. I think he first of all, that movie wouldn't have been half as fun without him. He steals every single scene, and he's fantastic. And a total unknown here. He's 53. He's been acting for quite a while. After that movie came out, he appeared in a lot of industry magazine covers. There was a big groundswell of support for him, and I think he's going to be the one to take it home.
Okay, so which of those winners that you just named off do you think shouldn't win?
Oh, I hate to say it, but I really don't think Sandra Bullock should be winning Best Supporting.
Sorry, you mean Best Acting?
Thank you, Rafer.
Actress.
Thank you, Rafer.
I just don't see that. And I think Carey Mulligan is up in that category, and she is so good in An Education. She's so wonderful in that. I like Sandra Bullock. I really do. I just don't think this is an Oscar-winning performance.
I like Sandra Bullock too, but I have to agree with you. Maybe this shouldn't be the one she should win for. All right. Well,
yeah.
The Oscar's going to be at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday on ABC. Rafer Guzman, thanks again. He's a Takeaway movie contributor and the film critic for Newsday.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning and happy Friday. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John Hockenberry. Coming up...
For those who have been trained by it, no discipline is blessed at the time of the painful.
We're going to talk with renowned musician Bobby McFerrin. We're going to ask him about his father, actually, and the power of family to change the direction of your life. That's coming up in a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says he's confident the House will pass the Senate's health care bill before the president leaves for Asia in mid-March.
I believe that, based on conversations that I've had in the building, that we are on schedule to get this through the House by then.
But members of the GOP say they'll try to delay the bill by forcing multiple votes and stretching the process out. Last night, a California man, John Patrick Bedell, opened fire on police officers at the Pentagon Metro Station. Pentagon Police Chief Richard Keevil says he's proud of how his officers responded.
I am pleased on a number of levels. The officers acted very quickly and decisively to neutralize him as a threat. There was no one else was injured. As you know, at that time of night, you have a lot of people coming and going, so we were fortunate that there was no other injuries.
Two police officers were wounded but have been released from the hospital. The gunman was shot and killed.
One of the snipers that terrorized the D.C. area back in 2002 has apologized to one of his victims. Lee Boyd Malvo sent a letter to a victim he shot and injured in Louisiana saying, quote, I'm truly sorry for the pain I caused you. Overseas, Pakistani officials say they've arrested another senior Afghan Taliban commander. The man, a former finance minister for the Taliban, was detained in Karachi yesterday. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Who does not know this song? And for many people, this is what they associate with the name Bobby McFerrin, the amazing voice behind Don't Worry, Be Happy and all those sounds that go behind it. But we're going to talk about something very different with Mr. McFerrin today. We want to talk a little bit about his family and how he came behind to his musical legacy. It's the story of the power of family.
How about that?
And,
yeah.
And shared history. Bobby McFerrin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, how are you?
So you're actually in New York this week to pay tribute to your father, who
That's
is
right, yeah.
Robert McFerrin.
I'm Junior.
You are the Junior. Most people don't know he was the first black man to perform at the Metropolitan Opera. He was there just days after Marian Anderson, of
That's
course.
That's correct. Who lived in the same apartment building that we did.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right.
Was she a noisy neighbor?
Not at all. She's very quiet, very sweet.
But your dad, Robert McFerrin, sang, he was the singing voice of Sidney Poitier in the film version of Porgy and Bess, and we have a little clip of that.
Bess, who is my woman now? You is, and you must laugh and sing and dance for two instead of
That is a beautiful sound. That's like pure chocolate
over
the ears. Yeah, he had a gorgeous, gorgeous voice. Years before he performed with the Met, he performed on the stage of the New York City Opera.
City Opera, right.
And it was an opera called Troubled Island. The libretto was Langston Hughes, and the music was written by my grandfather, William Grant Still.
How about that?
How about that? We're going to play a little bit. This is kind of sketchy audio. It's from actually a rehearsal, I believe, of the 1949 production with your dad performing in Troubled Island.
I love and I see.
a story behind this opera, and your dad is a part of this period.
That's funny. I've never heard that clip.
You haven't? Really,
no, I haven't heard it. No, that's wonderful.
Well, this opera was kind of pivotal in a number of different ways. It was it was written by two black men, not just white. It was the first opera by an African American to be performed at a major by a major company. It prominently featured some African Americans in the lead. But actually, the thing that people may not realize is that most of the people in the cast were white people painted black. The two stars.
Wow.
Robert Weed was a white guy that they put dark makeup on him.
Right.
And so your dad was one of these.
Right.
He was one of the rare, true people of color on the stage.
Well, you know, one thing I remember as a kid growing up is that whoever the black singers were in New York City at the time, they always seemed to congregate in our apartment because the place was always full of black people singing. And it was actually a wonderful experience as a kid sort of hiding under the piano while they'd sing and talk about the opportunities or the lack of opportunities that they had to, you know, perform their art. You know,
we actually found a recording of your dad's spirituals.
This did you really?
We did. Let's play it for you here.
I got to lie down. How shall I rise? Got to lie down. How shall I rise? I got to lie down. How shall I rise? Here before the judgment bar. I got to lie down. How shall I rise? Got to lie down. How shall I rise? I got to lie down. How shall I rise? Here before the judgment bar. Dark was the night and cold the ground on which my Lord was laid. Great drops of sweat like blood ran down. In agony he prayed, I got to lie down. How shall I rise? Got to lie down.
You know this song?
I do well, yeah.
Did you ever sing it with your dad?
No, I never. Well, no, that's not true. One time we did. My sister, my mother, my dad, myself did a concert in St. Louis, I think in 1986. And it was just a one-time deal. It was my dad was the featured artist, and the rest of us were just sort of
You were the backup singers for the famous Robert McFerrin.
That's right, yeah.
Well, you went a very different way in your style of music. What do you think you took away from your dad?
Oh, first off, just good singing, just good technique, and just how to really approach a song, a piece of music. He believed that if you are a singer, you've been given a gift. You know, God has entrusted you with a gift, and you need to do everything that you can, first off, to take care of yourself, not only your voice, but yourself, because yourself was your instrument. Your body was your instrument. Your mind is your instrument. Your spirit is a big part of your instrument. And to this day, when I sing, in many ways, I feel like I'm praying, you know.
I sat across from your dad when he was being inducted into the Arkansas Hall of Fame, and he was a sweet, humble, soft-spoken man. I'm just wondering how you felt growing up, I guess, under his shadow. I mean, he was famous.
Well, you know, I think that's why it took me 27 years to figure out that I was a singer, because I was, he was this incredible vocalist, and I wanted to do something else, and so I decided on composition, you know, being a composer and a pianist. And what's really funny is that the whole time that I was playing piano, I never felt like I was really a pianist. You know, I always had this nagging suspicion that wasn't my instrument. And then just one day out of the blue, it just fell on me that I'm a singer. And I started working right away. It's really amazing. I got an audition at a piano bar. I was living in Salt Lake City at the time, and I sang five songs. I was hired. I started a month later.
What'd you sing?
One of the songs was "You Are the Sunshine of My Life," Stevie Wonder. Another one was a tune by a band called Blind Faith. Come down off your throne and leave your body alone. Somebody must change. And then I sang a tune by Joan Armatrading called Opportunity. Opportunity came to my door.
Did you do that when you were auditioning?
When I was down on my luck. No. I don't think I did. No.
When did you start doing the percussive things and the other stuff with your voice? How did it meld into that?
You know, in the beginning, I wasn't really sure what kind of singing I was going to do, if I was going to continue to do piano bars, though I didn't think so. I thought maybe I might be a jazz singer and have a band. And I even thought about, you know, maybe doing the sort of the singer with the Count Basie kind of band, you know, and do some Joe Williams and stuff like that. You know, I wasn't too sure. But the idea of being on stage by myself was really fascinating, and I kind of lifted the idea from Keith Jarrett's solo piano work. And I thought, well, what would it be like for a singer to be on stage by himself without a band, without any kind of accompaniment? And so I started working on that, you know. And I worked on it for 6 years before I actually did my first solo voice concert. And And that's become sort of the, you know, the root of the tree, actually, the tree trunk of everything else that I do.
That was Bobby McFerrin. He has a new album out in April called Vocabularies, his first in 8 years. We have an exclusive preview right now. Here's Wailers from Bobby McFerrin. You can hear that whole song on our site, thetakeaway.org.
And there's lots of web extras on the site. Next week, John's going to be co-hosting from Miami with our friends at WLRN. And while he's there, we're working with the BBC program World Have Your Say on a special project 2 months after the Haiti earthquake. What does Haiti need from the world right now? We want to hear from them, and they're going to want to hear from you. You can go to the website, thetakeaway.org, or call 877-8-MY-TAKE to find out. And want to find out which Oscar movies are the most worth seeing before Sunday and the red carpet and the Oscar awards? Go to thetakeaway.org to get the take from film critic Rafer Guzman, who you just heard from, and Takeaway producing Kristen Meinzner. You can hear their heated but friendly conversation all about the Oscars. That's at thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.